have you been following the kerfuffle in the letters to the New York Times? Author and, of course, Studio 360 host Kurt Anderson wrote in an op-ed that the sea change of the counterculture 60s, that revolution that led to so many freedoms for women, gays, minorities, also produced the unshackled, greedy, and some would say disastrous, financial practices of today. That thanks to the 60s, we are all, on the left and the right, shamelessly selfish. Well, the letters to the editor poured in, baby boomers saying, wait a minute, we weren't selfish, we selflessly fought for others' rights. And a letter also came from Paul Nevins, author of The Politics of Selfishness. Yesterday, the Times devoted a whole section to the question, are Americans selfish? We'll link you to that at hereandnow.org. But here now, Kurt Anderson, to talk about the to-do, but also his new novel, featuring baby boomer Karen Hollander, law professor and potential Obama Supreme Court nominee, until she withdraws her name because of something she did in the 60s. She's going to tell all about it in a memoir. What has Kurt Anderson excavating the 60s? His book is called True Believers. He joins us in the studio. Kurt, nice to talk to you again.
It's a pleasure to be here always.
Let's do the op-ed first, shall we?
Sure.
You were on a panel. You asked, why did the 60s revolution win, if you will, on the social and cultural fronts, women's rights, gay rights, a black president, ecology, et cetera, but lose on the economic front with old school free market ideas gaining traction? And you had this epiphany, which was?
Which was that people on the left tend to think of the 60s as their decade, when everything good began. And many, many great things began then, like civil rights, like women's rights, like gay rights, none of which I'm saying are selfish. But what also began were the more hedonistic aspects of the 1960s, which is to say you can dress any way you want, you can have a lifestyle of any kind you want, and, you know, do your own thing. And so the right, for the last 40 years, has sort of demonized the 60s. That's when everything went bad. That's when the culture got coarse. But I suddenly realized that it's not an incongruous contradiction that also what began in the right as a result of this libertarian upsurge and this personal liberty upsurge and I can do whatever I want upsurge was what became in the 80s and 90s and today this unfettered kind of market worshiping era where anything I want to do to make a profit is fine.
Okay. So, as we said, the letters poured in. Here's one from Jeremy Varon of Brooklyn. He writes, so Kurt Anderson lays today's corporate greed and the mega indulgences of the 1% on the 1960s era hippies who gave us organic farming, the feminists who create rape crisis centers, and the gay activists championing basic human rights. A generation of free market ideologues who hacked at regulations, unions, and what was left of the New Deal plays no role in his account of the ascent of the corporate license to pollute, offshore jobs, and overpaid executives. In other words, oh yes, the financial collapse, blame it on the hippies.
And not even the financial collapse. What I'm talking about is the larger cultural sense of old-fashioned extreme free marketism. And I'm not saying the hippies caused it. I'm saying that the late 60s, which we think of only having one stream, the counterculture, the liberal progressivism, all that, had another stream that I believe is flowing like mad today.
Well, and you know, the letters go on. Your critics say, wait a minute, not all 60s celebrants, you know, were celebrating hedonism. Many were celebrating, and you just said this, social justice and
right.
Doing things for others, selflessness.
No, exactly. And I wasn't saying the 60s, they're bad. I was saying something shares a taproot in the 60s, both these things that people on the left love and celebrate, the personal liberty and do my own thing movements, which are with us today still, that they share this taproot in the 60s with economic libertarianism. And in fact, in addition to angering people who thought I was condemning the civil rights movement and the great achievements of the 60s, I also have plenty of critics on the right, libertarians, to say, no, we're not jerks. We're not selfish. We're righteous in our belief in libertarianism. But I think, you know, there's a kind of headwaters where several rivers streamed out of.
And by the way, they meet in your new book. So let's talk about that. It's called True Believers, as we said. Your heroine lives through the 60s. She's a child in the 50s, but a child of the 60s. And she remembers all of it. JFK's assassination, the March on Washington, the Stonewall riots, Ernest Hemingway's suicide. Here's just another paragraph. The sudden arrival all at once of stereo records, the Beatles, Bic pens, Instamatic cameras, live transatlantic TV broadcasts, slip and slide and silly putty, frisbees, instant tanning lotion, stretch fabrics and bikinis. I mean, it goes on. McDonald's, the World's Fair.
And this was all in that paragraph. She's talking about 2 or 3 years in the early 60s, even before the 60s, as we know them, were really, really in full swing.
But is this you remembering this, or is this you at Wikipedia? What is this?
This is me certainly thinking about that sort of jazzy, zazzy part of the early 60s as they happened as a much younger child than she was, as a 7 or 8 year old. And then as I was thinking about it, as I was writing this book, taking notes of all those things as I recalled them, and then realizing, oh, there is, in addition to the solemn, serious, crisis-filled idea of the 60s, there was this nonstop fun aspect as well. And I just thought that was a way to, in a sort of fire hose of references, make that clear.
But what are you saying about the 60s in the book? Because, again, when we meet her, she's telling us this story that she's about to tell the world. She's now this 64-year-old eminent law professor.
And trying to uncover and investigate and unravel the mystery. She doesn't really know all that happened to her and all that she did and what the consequences were. So in real time today, she's trying to figure it out.
Yeah. And we don't want to give away the ending or even the middle, you know, because it's so much fun to read it. But we will say that as children, she and a couple of her male friends, they had tight bonds, and it was based on their love of James Bond, and they would act out the movies that they loved as they got older. And in college, there was actually a plot that went somewhat awry. And again, we don't want to give anything away. What are you saying? We know there was anti-war violence in the 60s. There was also a lot of anti-civil rights violence.
Well, I was really interested. I mean, we have read the memoirs of the famous weathermen and radicals who were fugitives and all that. I wanted to do a fresh take of people who were not famous radicals, who were only in a certain way briefly radicals and had this spectacular idea in mind to do, which went awry, as you say, but which they all walked away from and lived their lives like you and I have lived for the last 40 years and what that's like. And the getting away with it, which as I began writing it, I began thinking, wow, that's one of the things that could be said about that generation, the baby boom generation, is for so many of them, us, really people were able to have their cake and eat it too. Posture as revolutionaries and have a wild and crazy youth, but then lead a, you know, comfortable, successful lives afterward as well.
Author Kurt Anderson. His book is called True Believers. In his op-ed in the New York Times, he says selfishness may be a legacy of the 60s, to which Jeff Hunter responds on our Facebook page. Selfishness is the failing of individualism. You can join the conversation at facebook.com/hereandnowradio. More of ours in 1 minute. Here and Now. Welcome back to our conversation with Kurt Anderson, whose recent column about selfishness being one of the legacies of the 60s caused a major to-do. The 60s is also the genesis for his new novel, True Believers. The book's heroine, Karen, came of age in the 60s but left that past behind to become a celebrated attorney, an official in the Clinton administration, a possible Supreme Court nominee. And now at the age of 64, Karen's about to put her reputation in jeopardy by writing a memoir that explores how in college she and her friends began to escalate the James Bond capers they acted out as kids.
I admire your courage, Miss
Trench. Sylvia Trench. I admire your luck, Mr.
Bond. James Bond.
A scene from Dr. No. And as teenagers, Karen and her friends acted out scenes from Ian Fleming's books in public, pretending to be spies on missions. But, Kurt Anderson, we don't want to make light of today's security concerns. We couldn't help but think that today, if a kid mistakenly brings a fork into grade school, you know, there's 10 police cars there. Suddenly, your front page news.
And then there are pictures on Facebook that will never leave of that.
That's right. Then you could be making believe you were in a James Bond movie and then elevate it just a little bit and, you know, maybe come too close to the edge of a cliff that you don't really want to go over, and nobody would know.
That's right. And getting obsessed with James Bond and imagining yourself as fictional characters, I mean, that's existed as a thing since Emma Bovary got over-invested in the story she read. But I think in the 60s it became a bigger thing, and I think lots of people starting then and continuing now fictionalize themselves and role play and have avatars and have pseudonyms. And I think the boundary lines between fiction and reality actually started getting blurrier then. And that's part of the story I wanted to tell.
Why James Bond?
Because James Bond, it seems to me, as that character in those books and the first movies all happened in the early 60s, as the Cold War was at its absolute height, it was this moment of real life and the culture coming together in this extraordinary way. And I could imagine, I had my own little spy obsessions. I kept files on people. I had listening devices that I would listen to my sisters.
Oh, my brother did the same thing.
Well, exactly. So that it just carried a little further. But to me, James Bond sort of embodied a certain part of the early 1960s.
Well, and then your character in present day gets to constantly look at the world through James Bond. Wow, that Al-Qaeda plot, that could have been in a James Bond film.
Well, exactly. And she leaves Bond as a 15, 16-year-old and realizes that John Le Carré is whom she should really be reading. But then, as life goes on, and certainly after 9/11, she realizes, no, wait, the world is kind of James Bondish if you look closely.
By the way, you weave your character Karen's present, you know, 64, eminent law professor, with her past, teenager in the 60s, with the story of her 17-year-old granddaughter, Waverly, who's caught up in the Occupy movement.
Yeah.
What are you saying there?
Well, it was interesting. I had her caught up in a movement when I finished this book in August of last year that had no name, that didn't exist.
Right.
Suddenly, the next month, it has a name, and it really exists. And so I had to do some revisions to kind of call it Occupy. And I was writing this as my children were when my children were teenagers, and so I was interested in what it's like to be a teenager in the present day versus what it was like to be a teenager, you know, in 1967 or 68. And so that's why the granddaughter becomes such an important character and is really, in a certain way, the person to whom Karen is closest. And since I, as you say, alternate between the 60s and now, I wanted to give a sense of you know, youth then, youth now, compare and contrast.
Well, but as we said, one of the comparisons is there was so much more looseness back then. I mean, you have a scene where Karen and her friends go into a Chicago hotel. They're making believe that they are people with all sorts of different foreign backgrounds, one from Russia. And they pull off this sort of caper at a bar. They're too young to be at the bar. The police get called. That would not be
correct.
Possible.
That would not be possible in so many ways. I mean, that's one of the big differences, I think, is that children, 13, 14-year-olds, were allowed to run free in a way that wasn't the case today. There was no security at office buildings to speak of. It was more of a Wild West time in all kinds of ways. And that, I think, was a lot of what made being young in the 60s being young in the 60s.
You tell it in a woman's voice really well.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm not, you know, authors of all stripes should be able to write about stripes they are not.
Correct.
But how, I mean, did you try this out on people like your wife? Did you actually try to speak it yourself and feel it yourself?
I did. And it's also my first person book. So I really, I did sketches and experiments with different voices until I felt like I'd hit it right, at least to then go forward. I did try it out on my wife, and certainly my wife and my two daughters and my agent and my editors are all women, and they were very helpful in giving course corrections. And it was interesting being essentially in the head of this imaginary woman for 2 years and beginning to, I think, feel about, especially in the 60s and 70s, how women were not taken seriously in this extraordinary way, that they had to sort of man up in that generation of women coming to work, all those things. So, you know, as you said, I'm happy you were persuaded, because it was, you know, it was slightly daunting to say, I'm going to be this woman for, you know, a life.
You mean for quite a while, you lived her.
Yeah, I really did. I mean, I you know, I didn't dress up in different clothing. I really didn't go all in that much, but I really did have to sort of try to channel a woman. You know, and I think maybe I was helped a little bit because in many ways I'm not a stereotypical man. I don't watch sports. I danced ballet as a child.
All
these things that if I were that boy today and I was that boy's parent, I would say, I guess he's going to be gay. And in fact, as it happens, I'm not. So I don't think I'm a very stereotypical man, and that may have allowed me a little bit easier to get into the head of a woman.
And by the way, again, this excavation, this anthropological dig through the 60s that you do in this book and also in your op-ed in the New York Times that's just provoked all this response. Who are you because of however the 60s touched you?
That's a good question. I was a little, I'm 6 years younger, five and a half years younger than my character. And what was interesting, as you will remember, about the 60s is that those 5 or 6 or 7 years difference in age made all the difference in the world. Right. I was 13 when 1968 happened. That's very different than being 18 when 1968 happens. Absolutely. Being young then at this remarkable once-a-century historical moment shapes everything
Do you think it made you selfish?
I think it made me selfish in the way that all of us are selfish today, and all of us kind of look out for our own interests, desires, indulge ourselves in ways that, for better and for worse, was not so much the case before the 1960s.
Well, you sparked quite a bit of conversation about the 60s. Kurt Anderson, his book is True Believers. We'll link you to his op-ed titled The Downside of Liberty. You don't pick the titles.
Had nothing to do with it.
Right, which was in the New York Times at herenow.org. Kurt, terrific read. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And by the way, his characters in the book go to a Monkees concert in the 60s, and Jimi Hendrix was the opener. That was true. That actually happened, but it is not true that the Daughters of the American Revolution complained that his act was too erotic, and that's why he was thrown off the tour. He left because he was tired of hearing people scream, "We want the Monkees." Here and Now is a production of WVUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Join us to see what the week brings here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.